So one of the things that sort of one of the guidelines that are given to priors is that new priors and so on is that since obviously a priory is very much focused on providing, a place where basically lay people, non-monastics can come and do their practice. We're obviously really geared towards the prior is wanting to kind of be a little bit more attuned to kind of what life is like out there for all of you. And one of the aspects of that is that priors are encouraged to track the news, kind of have a sense, have a finger on the pulse of the news, seeing, being aware in general of what's going on. And as we all know, what's been in the news over the last year has been a little more, shall we say, a bit more exciting than personally I would like, a little more dramatic than other times in my life. Most of the time when I check the news, I tend to look at sort of interviews and reports going on. So it's not just written, it's people talking. And one woman I was listening to, she was being interviewed. She's an historian. And her comment was how incredibly sad she is these days with seeing what's going on. So very much kind of highlighting how for her and many, many people, how their what reaction to what's going on nowadays is that of a very, very deep sadness. Equally, I remember listening to another person, a number of people, and as one might expect, a lot of them were extremely angry with what was going on. And again, to make it clear, not just about things going on in the US, but things going on in various places around the world. Another sentiment that was expressed very strongly was, how afraid they were, how afraid many, many people were. So I think that's enough of a spectrum, sadness, anger, fear. And I would imagine that for many of you, you can very much sort of identify with, all of those three things in different proportions based on kind of what's been going on. One of the ways that we approach things from a Buddhist point of view, from a Buddhist practice point of view, is there are external events going on, and then there's also recognizing, experiencing the reactions, the feelings that we personally are having relative to that. So what I wanted to do this morning and talk about was if you find that any one of those three fairly strong emotions are going on for you, how do we look at those things from a Buddhist point of view? And based on how we're looking at them, how we're understanding them, how what's best practice, so to speak, how do we work with those? Kind of what direction do we go in? What's come to my mind as a really good beginning place for that is in sort of a fairly broad brush way to look at the 16 precepts that we have in our tradition of Zen Buddhism. The first three of those 16 precepts are the three refuges or the three treasures. We talk about them as the three treasures, three refuges, very interchangeably. So there's the Buddha treasure, you know, the refuge of the Buddha, the refuge of the Dharma, and the refuge of the Sangha, or the treasure of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. There are many different ways of talking about the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. The way I want to present it at this point is, in many respects, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is a blueprint. It's mapping out the structure of Buddhist practice. And sort of Buddhist practice and what the way Buddhism is put together. It's the way it's structured. And again, realize that there are a number of other ways, number of other layers or perspectives on the three treasures that can also be talked about, but I want to focus just on this one for today. And so we have the Buddha treasure is, in this case, it's referring to the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived some 2,500 years ago. Actually, it's getting closer to 2,600 now, I think. And had his awakening under the Bodhi tree at the age of 35. And based on that awakening, that deep experience and understanding, taught for 44 more years. And the teaching that he did to undoubtedly thousands and thousands of people over that period of time, that's the Dharma, you know, the teaching that was passed on from him to the present day. The Sangha initially meant the community of monks who were kind of like the representatives, the people that you looked up to, you know, you aspired to be like them in the way they conducted their lives, the way they did their practice. Nowadays, more and more commonly, we refer to the Sangha as simply the community of people who are practicing, you know, doing a Buddhist practice. Back in, during the time of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, you basically became a monk or ordained as a monk simply by stating out loud, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. Nowadays we've made it a little bit more ceremonial than that. So that's the first three precepts of the 16. Is that taking refuge in, recognizing the treasure of those three aspects of the structure, the functioning of Buddhist practice. And then we get to the three pure precepts. The way I want to present the three pure precepts is that they're basically a sort of an outline, a broad description that embraces all of the 10 great precepts. The 10 great precepts are all of the myriad ways with body or speech or mind that we can do things that end up creating consequences for us. Consequences that are, you know, over time and becoming more aware of them, they're consequences that we're like, I would rather not have that in the future. And in a very broad sense, a general sense, you can say that the 10 great precepts are talking about, at kind of a micro level, all of the various ways in which human beings can get up to stuff that cause their own suffering or dissatisfaction for themselves and others. So in between the three refuges, the three treasures, and the 10 great precepts, you have in essence sort of a fulcrum, a pivot point in the three pure precepts. Now, of course, the driver of what the way in which we come to see these guidelines for practice is all through the practice of meditation. And again, taking from some of Great Master Dogen's teachings, he says to study Buddhism, maybe nowadays a better way of putting that is to practice Buddhism, and primarily to do Buddhist meditation, is to study the self, is to study ourselves, is to become aware of ourselves. We become aware of all of our tendencies, our habits, our behaviors of body, speech, and mind. And so the three pure precepts, the first of the three is, it says, the guideline, the recommendation is cease from evil. And evil, of course, fairly laden word, fairly strong word. What it's pointing to, though, is the fact that saying cease from evil, it's in essence saying cease from doing that which causes you suffering over and over and over again. And in a way, if you can kind of sort of loosely hold on to the word evil as, yes, that's a very heavy term. But think of it in the sense of the ceasing from. And you're, in other words, you're ceasing from, you're working on doing less and less harm to yourself, and by extension, harm to others. So in that sense, it's a heavy term, but it's a heavy term because the sort of the turning of that around is a very heavy, very strong in the sense of improving your life and making things better for you. And wouldn't you want to do that for yourself? I find it interesting if I look at that question for myself, I sometimes realize that there have been many times in the past where I don't think too much of myself in the sense of, and this may be the case for a number of you too. It's like, I don't necessarily always think I should be nice or do things that are best for me in the deepest sense. But look at ceasing from evil as ultimately a very, don't focus on the evil, but the ceasing from. In other words, you are actually doing something of extreme benefit and kindness to yourself. In working on that. Now, the other two of the three pure precepts is do only good and do good for others. And all of these three aspects are aspects of our practice in life. There are times when we are working on the negative habits of body, speech, and mind, or working on those behaviors which cause ourselves, which cause ourselves and others suffering. And that's something we always want to keep coming back to. We always want to be open to, or is there something here that I can continue to look into to minimize the dissatisfactoriness, the suffering I'm causing perhaps self and other. I remember once, many decades ago, realizing that if all we can manage in this lifetime is to refrain from some of our really bad habits of body, speech, and mind, some of our tendencies to cause ourselves suffering, our tendency to cause others suffering, that's actually a real improvement in the world. Because we're now doing less harm, we're causing less of a mess. And I remember saying to myself, well, at least I'm not raping and pillaging and murdering and etc. Well, that's good. I heard one monk asked Reverend Master Jiyu a question once and said something along the lines of realizing that he had been able to, by and large, really kind of get a grip on that, and he was no longer, creating tons of evil or causing a lot of harm. And she nodded and said yes. Partly, I think she had noticed that. And she said, but don't stop there. And that, of course, is where do only good and do good for others come into play. So again, it's like there are these three aspects, three areas in our life: to cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others. They're always going to be active in our lives. They're always going to be aspects that we want to keep cultivating and working on. And the reason I'm saying that and making a point of that is because what I'm going to say next, the way I want to proceed, is focusing primarily on the ceasing from evil aspect. But I want you to know that the do only good and do good for others, those are also very, very, very important aspects. And, in future talks, we can touch on those. The reason I wanted to focus on the cease from evil aspect, the ceasing from suffering, the putting down of habits of body, speech, and mind that cause self and other suffering, is because those are very, very much tied into any time we are aware of experiencing very strong emotions, like the ones I started off with, like being very, very sad, being very, very angry, being very, very fearful. That should alert us to, okay, the recommendations of the teachings that go with the cease from evil are very, very pertinent here. They really help us address how to proceed with things. What's really important and really, really helpful when we're experiencing any of those three strong emotions I was mentioning, or any similar ones, and ones that might be very, shall we say, more on the negative side, try to be open to and see what that sadness or fear or anger, what's the context that's going on there? And by that I mean not only the external triggers, the events that may have brought that up, but more so, is it not the case, and this was the case in this one interview where, this one historian was saying about events going on in the world these days, she said, I am very, very sad with what's going on. And that's what I mean by the context. It's always the case whenever those strong emotions are going on, they're always relative to a sense of a particular type of a self that's there. Unpack, sort of flesh out the story that's there with I'm very angry. Why? And what we'll come up with is all sorts of comments like, well, because that's not what I want to have happen. That's not what I want to have going on. I don't agree with that. Sort of sadness and anger, kind of in a general way, there, beneath them, there's a self that's there that's actually emoting things, having emotions that are going in roughly two different directions. One is a self that's deeply, deeply sad, i.e., feeling very, very hurt, and in a sense is feeling threatened or targeted, or beneath anger is usually a self that's feeling threatened, and basically it's the fight mode. I'm gonna do something about this. And at least from sort of the initial part, it's like I'm angry in the sense of I'm gonna just pump myself up here, and at the very least I'm gonna stand here really, really strongly and energetically and don't tread on me sort of approach. And of course, you know, with both of the sort of sadness moving and tending way, or the anger tending way, we can, you know, depending on how strong that is, we know that that can move in a lot of different directions. There are very, very few revolutions that have occurred at any level by people who are mostly in the mode of being sad. If you get my point there. It's, again, it's much more of a sadness is more of an internally directed or a sort of a what foregoing or forsaking, sort of being energetic and strong and so on. So as we, you know, as Dogen says, as we continue to study, i.e., as we continue to within meditation be aware of what's going on, we may also find that, okay, there's a self, and actually what it always boils down to, or what it comes down to, as sort of the initial state, is that of there is a self, and that self is concerned about its self-welfare. You know, it's concerned about how the self is going to do in the world. And so, out of, you know, and this is at a sort of a small, sort of healthy level, there's always going to be, whenever you have a self, there's always going to be a healthy level of fear, if I can put it that way. Fear being a sense of, yes, I am behind, I am on the page of wanting to take care of this self or preserve this self. And then, of course, fear can get stronger and stronger depending on the circumstances that we're in. Usually, the more that self is under threat, the more that self perceives itself to being compromised, the greater the fear, going all the way up to, you know, terror, and then, of course, if it gets really extreme, it can go into trauma in a lot of different ways. So, for example, shell shock, as it was called back in World War I, was that sense of self-preservation in the time of battle and wartime, that fear level that was there just got so over triggered, so pushed, that to one degree or another, in various ways, our body and mind, our organism just started, what's the right way to put it, just got completely overloaded in various ways and wasn't able to function in a normal way or in a kind of an average way. So what I'm offering is that in the circumstances that all of us find ourselves in these days, in this country and in this world, where we are finding ourselves being triggered perhaps more often and more strongly than previous times with things like sadness and anger and fear, as you continue to do your practice with that, I'm contending that what you will find underlying all of that is this sort of initial crystallizing of a sense of a self, a separate self, and what goes with that is what I'm calling fear. Fear, concern for self-preservation, and so on. We're really getting into very existential areas. What I also want to present is that if you continue in your meditation practice, this is what's always going to happen. You're always going to sink down through. You're always going to encounter aspects of sadness or anger to varying degrees. And the training is always going to keep pulling you back down into this very existential place of a self and fear. Always. That's always the direction that the training is going to take you in terms of that aspect that I was talking about with the first of the three pure precepts. You know, the looking at, the noticing, the experiencing of our habits of body, speech, and mind that cause suffering. And all of those habits of suffering, they all boil down to, they all keep coming back down to this initial creating of becoming conscious of a separate self and that element of fear that's there. This sort of cycling, if you will, of meditating and dropping down into and experiencing very intense sadness, very intense fear, very intense anger, we can drop down into that and quite rightly, you know, we can get freaked out by it. This is not pleasant stuff. It's very challenging. And so we might pop back out of that again in various ways. We might feel like we need to do something to learn how to manage our anger or how to work with our sadness, you know, from the point of view of like therapy or even, you know, medically and so on. We may also, in those instances, we may get so freaked out by the intensity of what we encounter that we just go shooting off into all manner of just ways of just kind of distracting ourselves and trying to ignore those things. So in that sense, it's like, you know, we kind of sink deeper in our meditation practice, and then one way or the other we might find ourselves just popping back out again just because of the sheer intensity. Now there are a number of passages in Buddhist teachings, in the Dharma. There are a number of passages in the various scriptures we sing that all point to what to do when you find yourself in the depths of this place. when I first went to Throssell, the abbot, the then abbot, Reverend Master Dyson Morgan, and I think it's the case with all senior monks, well, it's probably the case with everybody, it's really important that in the, you know, in the day-to-day intensity of our lives, it's always nice to have something that we find relaxing and calming. You know, I think that's what hobbies, that's one of the roles of having a hobby, having some recreational activity you can do. And, you know, you'd have to know kind of what River Master Dyson Morgan was like, but his favorite thing to do to relax when he had some rest time was to do stone carving. You know, a big heavy hammer and stone chisel, and he'd go out there and carve. He carved some absolutely beautiful stone statues and sort of stone calligraphy and stuff. And one of the works that he did was it was basically a plaque that had written on it that he put in, set in the stone wall right at the entryway to Throssell Buddhist Abbey, and it said, "Om to the one who leaps beyond all fear." And those of you who have been around for a while should immediately recognize that, wait a minute, that's in the Litany of the Great Compassionate One. So what I would like to do is talk about when you get to that place of fear, what the teaching is. What's the recommendation for Buddhists, for people doing Buddhist practice, when they come to this place of fear? So the, you know, it starts out with the intoning of the title of the scripture, which is the Litany of the Great Compassionate One. Who's the Great Compassionate One? That's just another title for Avalokiteshvara. Kuan Yin in Chinese, Kanzeon in Japanese. And a litany is basically, a listing, a reading off of, a listing, a description of. And so this is basically, this is a scripture that's going to be presenting a litany, a list, a describing of the Great Compassionate One, describing Avalokiteshvara. So it starts out by saying, adoration to the Triple Treasure. So adoration to the first three of the 16 precepts, the three treasures, the three refuges. Depending on how many Buddhist books you've read, oftentimes if they're written by monks or written by very senior, very long-term lay people, they will always start off by dedicating the book to the three treasures. So basically, you know, coming to a temple, coming to do the practice, we don't use the word adore very much these days, but you're coming as an expression of adoring the three treasures. You know, the implication being, this is what I, you know, I'm wishing to take refuge in. This is what I'm regarding as a treasure, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So already you have that right attitude of mind. I'm coming here because this is a place, this is a practice that, you may not say it's a practice I adore, but, you know, put into that the word that seems best for you. So adoration to the three treasures, and then adoration to Kanzeon, who is the Great Compassionate One. It's just two ways of saying the same thing. Adoration to the one who is great compassion, adoration to great compassion. And then the next line is, Om to the one who leaps beyond all fear. Om, hail, sort of, you know how when you sometimes meet people or they do something, you just sort of give them a nod, give them a look, like two thumbs up. It's like, yes, that was good. So in other words, you know, kudos to, that's not a strong enough word, but basically, Om, you know, the word Om is, it's describing a Sanskrit letter, the letter Om, that in sort of the ancient Indian understanding, Om, the letter Om is a letter that embraces, includes all sound. All of sound being one way of describing all of reality. It embraces the entire spectrum, all of the vibrations, all the energy of reality. So what it's saying is, when you come to that place of fear, you need, in order to continue forward, to do this practice, the way forward in this practice is leaping beyond all fear. So that's what we need to unpack. It's interesting using the word leaping. What's important to see with that particular word is it doesn't say step beyond all fear. It says leap. And leap kind of implies the only reason we need to leap is if what's in front of us, there's kind of a gap. Like we're standing on one side of a stream and the other side, which has sure footing on it, is quite a distance away. Or maybe the stream has cut through the rock or the soil quite a bit. The stream's down many, many feet. You know, it's creating kind of a canyon of sorts. It's implying that to go from fear to take the next step, it's going to be a fairly significant shift from what's already been there. And what's already been there has been, you know, the sadness, the anger, the fear, the association with, the identifying with being a separate self. And so the leap is going to be something very different. So what's also important is the word beyond. So if I've said this reasonably well, you should also be associating fear and anger and sadness, which are stand-ins for all of our emotions. All of those are representing the world of the identifying with a separate self. And what this is saying is that the way forward is going to be a way in which we have to stop identifying with that separate self, going to be beyond the orientation, the identifying with a separate self. So it says, Om to the one who leaps beyond all identification with self. You know, and as you've found out with this practice, it's particularly with Soto Zen, it tends to be fairly gradual and paced. So step by step or leap by leap in smaller ways, sometimes bigger ways, we need to come back to that fear or anger or sadness and then take the next leap beyond that particular way of identifying with the self. So the next few lines, and I think these next three lines kind of wrap things up, sum things up very, very nicely for now. So right after Om to the one who leaps beyond all fear, it says, having adored him, it's the old translation, we've written in here in our scripture books, having adored her. And a quick aside, in ancient India, compassion, great compassion, was regarded as being a male attribute, or shall we, I meant to say male attribute as in masculine, not necessarily an attribute that only men had, but it was masculine in the sense of it was regarded as a very active, compassion was an active thing you did or expressed. It wasn't, as opposed to, it wasn't a receptive, sort of passive thing. So leaping beyond is certainly a very active thing. But anyway, having adored great compassion, may I enter into the heart of the noble adored Kanzeon. And then it says, her life is the completion of meaning. It is pure, it is that which makes all beings victorious and cleanses the path of all existence. So right, that's just spelled it out completely to my mind. In other words, what it's saying is if you take that leap into the heart of great compassion, and I'll unpack that a little bit more in a bit, but if we make that leap to great compassion, going in that direction is the completion of meaning. It's where you will find true meaning in your life by taking that leap into compassion. It is that which makes all beings victorious. In other words, whenever you are experiencing great sadness, great anger, great fear, and you're able to open your heart in the way that they're describing in terms of this adoration or that welcoming or that looking towards great compassion as the refuge, whatever anger, sadness, fear comes up, you will be victorious. In other words, it's going to work out. And also, it cleanses the path of all existence. So, anything that we encounter, all situations in which, you know, we're experiencing that sadness and fear and anger, it will, great compassion will resolve it, it will cleanse it. Now it's really important to say that we may not know how it's going to cleanse it. We may not know how, in the midst of these horrible, difficult challenges we're in, we may not know how we're going to get through. But it's saying, if you can bring your mind to opening up to great compassion, that's the way forward, always. So what this is doing is it's describing, in these few lines, it's describing a whole unfolding, a whole process that unfolds in the course of our practice. How do we leap beyond all fear, or how do we leap beyond even just the fear that we're having right now, let alone, don't even worry about all of it, just what about the stuff that's right there right now, or the anger that's there, or the sadness that's there. This is kind of a circular way of talking about it, and it takes time to kind of see that this is kind of how it's working, but to call on great compassion in the midst of these challenging situations. Calling upon great compassion is at the same time we call upon great compassion, it also means that we're open to great compassion. It also means that we're actually regarding great compassion as the refuge. So we do that when we meditate. You may not even have to bring to mind kind of adoring great compassion or asking for great compassion's help. It's perfectly fine to do that out loud or internally if you're sitting with others. But the actual act of meditation, of being with that which is there, which may happen to be very, very challenging, that is the expression of great compassion, right there. Or you can see, if you put it another way, oh, I'm really, really sad, oh, whatever, don't be a wimp, buck up, get on with things. That's not being very compassionate. And equally with, you know, disregard for anger or fear. So first and foremost, compassion is actually expressed when we're willing to be with who we are, what we're feeling right at that moment. So in a way, we need to, over time, keep coming back to applying the remedy of meditation for everything that we encounter, particularly everything challenging we encounter. And we find that by being meditative, that kind of automatically opens us up to the movement of compassion, the expression of compassion. It's not that we leap beyond all fear, it's that we do what's good to do, i.e. meditate, we're with what's there, and in the process of doing that, the leaping beyond all fear occurs. I think the things that, you know, to kind of bring this back to each one of our direct personal experiences with strong emotions going on and so on, is that over time, the way forward is to, as best we can, keep sort of lowering ourselves into being willing to experience and feel the depths of whatever intensity there might happen to be there. So over and over again in our practice, when things get rough, we tend to orient ourselves through just kind of doing this over and over again. We find that we orient ourselves towards going into it even more, kind of hanging in there even a little bit longer with the intensity that's there. And, you know, again, this is in part why, you know, it takes months and years of doing this practice, is because it takes time to kind of equilibrate, to get comfortable with kind of dipping ourselves ever more deeply into us, into who we are. And don't lose sight of, don't let go of great compassion. That's why great compassion, Avalokiteshvara, is one of the shrines in the meditation hall, in the ceremony hall. That's why it's one of the two fundamental aspects of our meditation. It's kind of constantly opening ourselves up to and allowing that great compassion to come into us. And at least at times you can really have this sense of getting pulled ever more deeply into and experiencing just this profound darkness in whatever way you know you might experience it, sort of like you're just coming face to face with this you know existential sort of experience of being a separate self through fear or anger or sadness and many other things. Don't lose heart. Use what this practice has to offer, all of the myriad things to keep bolstering your trust and faith that yes, you're going in the right direction. You know, keep allowing yourself to be there within the midst of the, you know, the strength of experiencing yourself and what's there. When it gets to the point of when you start getting in the area of, I can't handle this anymore, or this is too much, or this is too painful, you know, again, use everything that's available to kind of help and support you in whatever way you need to support yourself. But just when it gets darkest or most difficult, hang in there, and then somehow the leap happens. Maybe just in a smallish way with what you've been working on in that particular area, or maybe in a big way where you've suddenly experienced, you know, the fullness, the unity, the interdependence, interconnection of all things. Or maybe it's just that you experience that this very hard and solid and dark sense of self suddenly, quite extraordinarily, just seems to unsolidify what seemed stuck and carved in stone, just liquefies and moves. And when it liquefies and moves, there's a greater or lesser sense of it's actually still, it's actually not separate, it's actually part of a much greater whole. One moment it seemed unresolvable, unmanageable, unbearable. The next minute, it just shifted and moved into a greater degree of ease and harmony. If you've read anything about monastic life, Buddhist monastic life, particularly, you don't have to go back too long, but you know, accounts of like monastic life when Great Master Dogen was alive in the 1200s, or I mean, it varied from one tradition to another, but in many respects, it was really rough. What's interesting to my mind is that by and large, all of us right now in this country, in this world, and given how rough it's getting, we're all basically living in the world monastery. Circumstances, conditions are such that existential sense of self, separate self, is just getting pinged over and over again. So it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity to keep taking refuge in the three treasures, you know, to keep clarifying what really helps in times of need. So yes, you know, keep bringing to mind as and when, and it will continue to be this way in the near future when events really bring up all of this intense stuff. Try to bring to mind kind of what I've been saying, what Buddhism is saying, what it's pointing to. Home to the one who leaps beyond all fear. Home to the one who leaps beyond just identifying with a separate, isolated self. You will be victorious. It's the completion of meaning. It cleanses the path of all existence. And kind of as a spoiler for future talks, not necessarily next Sunday, but sometime in the future, this is actually how we come to understand more deeply what it is to do good and to do good for others. It all comes from knowing the heart of great compassion, which is always found leaping beyond the separate self. Okay.